I've seen some interesting debates online about, you know, product people shouldn't be in charge of viability. And I think that's a very dangerous precedent to have, because, you know, as a product person, if you're inherently tied to the success of, does this generate revenue or does this move the needle in some way in the company, even if it's a free product, does it lead to generating revenue in some way eventually? If you're disconnected from that, I just feel as if you could have a really amazing, beautiful product and still fail because it has the wrong business model, or a business model that just doesn't make sense for the company.
Welcome to the Scandinavian Product Podcast, the very first episode. I'm Afonso and I'm your host. Today's episode is really meaty and juicy. My guest is the one and only David Bland. David is one of my biggest references in product. He's the author of the book Testing Business Ideas, co-written together with Alexander Westervelder and part of the Strategizers book series. In this episode, David and I talked about a bunch of things. We discussed the most important risks to address when testing business ideas, how to go about mapping them, and why it's so important to test ideas as a team. This is also something I talked about at Y Oslo last year. We also went through the biggest challenges when testing viability, how to approach willingness to pay, why we should sequence our experiments, how can product leaders foster a culture of continuous discovery, and so much more. And speaking of continuous discovery, make sure you check the latest interview available in the Scandinavian Product newsletter. I sat down with Kristen Berger to discuss all things continuous discovery and his new venture in Norway called UX Signals. Check the link in the show notes to learn more from Kristen. Now, without further ado, David Bland. Okay, we're live. David, welcome. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's such a pleasure to have you. You have written what to me is the best resource for any product team, any founder who's looking to discover value and test their ideas. So first of all, congrats. But I know you've seen so many of different contexts, like startups, scale-ups, large organizations. You've helped so many people test ideas and discover value. So I do have to ask, do people get it? Are we making progress as an industry towards the right direction? What have you seen lately, David?
I think we are. I think the progress is maybe slower than I'd like to see, because topics, you know, 10, 15 years ago that are really based in the fundamentals are still needed today. I'm noticing a lot of people want to jump to the experiments, but they don't have the risk properly extracted and prioritized. So I think maybe that's part of company cultures or just human nature, where we just want to do, you know, we want to jump to action, but without tying it back to your riskiest assumption, you know, you may not be working on the most meaningful stuff. So I find that people are still need to be pulled back into that direction of what's your risk and how do we frame your risk, and then let's, you know, use that as a basis of our experiments. And I think people just still want to jump to the experiments right away.
Yeah, no, that's that makes a lot of sense. And I think one of your biggest contributions that I see a lot of teams using is the assumption mapping, which forces them to actually think about this, you know, the riskiest assumptions. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about assumption mapping in general and kind of how you like to frame these things when you teach teams?
Yeah, happy to. So long story, you know, back, I would say early 2010-ish, I was working with some companies trying to get them to frame their, you know, assumptions and start experiments. And what I've failed over and over again as I was trying to find a good way to prioritize the risk, and I was trying stack ranking and I was trying all these different things. I was usually using some kind of canvas, you know, as the basis. So I'd use something like the business model canvas or the value prop canvas, and I would try to get people into the experiments. And then it wasn't until I started working with Jeff Gottdelf and Josh Seiden, who wrote Lean UX and some other books since then as well. And they had a 2x2 in there, and I was like, oh, maybe I can use this 2x2. And I was working with them back at Neo, which was kind of like a lean startup agency that we had. And I was based in San Francisco, and they were based in New York. And, you know, I kept saying, well, this is a good start, but here are all the things that people are still struggling with. So I just kept customizing it. It's almost unrecognizable now. I think the one axis is still important, unimportant, but I've changed the other axis at least two or three times since then. And I was just really trying to get people to prioritize. And so I finally ended up on something that was you know, let's talk about importance of your risk, but also how much evidence do you have? Do you have any observable evidence that supports that, you know, assumption? And so it wasn't until I landed there, which was several years later, I have to say it was probably 5 years of working with teams to get to that point. And using that as is kind of like a structured conversation with teams to say, hey, what are the riskiest assumptions, the things with the, you know, the most importance where we have the least amount of evidence, and then let's frame our experimentation off of those.
Mm-hmm. So when you say like assumptions, do you differentiate them across different types of risks, correct? What, do you want to tell us a bit more about the risks that you basically think teams should be aware of?
Yeah, I tend to come back to this sort of nugget or core of design thinking or user-centered design, which is a lot of, is it desirable? So what kind of risk do you have around your value prop and your customer segments and jobs to be done, all that? And then viable, which is more about cost and revenue for the most part, you know, financial viability kind of risk. And then feasibility, which is a lot of kind of the can we. So it's, you know, things like activities, resources, technology risk. But I also, there's some other outside influences on that, such as regulatory risk or things, patents, things like that. So, you know, I like that framing, even though there's some other circles you could add and other themes you could certainly add to that. I find the more that we add, the more it just overcomplicates everything. And so I keep coming back to those three themes of desirable, viable, and feasible, which are kind of like the do they, should we, you know, is this going to make a profit, and can we?
Mm-hmm. So for someone who's listening and is thinking, okay, I have a great idea, then from what you said right now, where they need to start is start mapping out their assumptions on desirability, viability, feasibility, map them on the assumption mapping 2x2, which goes from important, not important, evidence, no evidence. And then we take the no evidence, most important assumptions, which are the riskiest assumptions, and we prioritize those. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I like it a little better than stack ranking, because stack ranking is kind of one-dimensional and people just kind of rank things from top to bottom, whereas I think it's a more nuanced conversation with, well, this is important, but how much evidence do we have? Because it doesn't make sense to keep experimenting, or you have diminishing returns anyway when it comes to experimenting on things that are almost completely known. And so what I'm trying to push the teams to is kind of the uncomfortable zone of things that, hey, if we ignore this, this could make or break the whole idea that we're trying to have a successful business around. So I keep pulling it back to like riskiest assumption or leap of faith assumption, whatever you want to call that. But it's a small kind of cluster of things that, if proven wrong, will cause the whole thing to fail.
Mm-hmm. So when you're doing those exercises, as you know, assumption mapping and so on, what are the most important people to be in the room? Because what I've seen, for example, is teams that, you know, there's a designer starts doing this by herself, for example, and then perhaps it's more difficult to get the feasibility assumptions right, or, you know, some viability assumptions. And even like executives, although I don't think they use assumption mapping that much, but sort of what are the most important roles you think should be in the room when we do assumption mapping? And is it important that we gather different roles in those discussions?
It's very important. I think it's one of the hardest parts when I'm working with early stage founders is they're trying to do it all themselves. And so what I'm often recommending, I just did a workshop a few weeks ago with a bunch of founders, and they were mostly solo founders in the room. Mm-hmm. And my feedback to them was go find outside expertise or mentors that can help you look at the blind spots here. Because if you're, let's say, a technical co-founder or a technical founder, you may not have as much ability to say, is this, how big is this market and what should I price it at? And try to pull in people that kind of make it more well-rounded. In bigger companies, that's less the problem because you do have all these different functions. The challenge there is, can we get the functions together to talk to each other and have a structured conversation about risk? And so quite often, I'm trying to pull together, you know, from desirability, I want people from design, user research, market research, sales, anybody that really understands how to craft a really well-positioned value proposition that's unique, for people that understand the customers really well, their jobs, pains, and gains, all of that. From viability, it's kind of a mix of, it's usually product, sometimes finance. We have to bring in folks from the org that can understand the numbers a bit, you know, what are our gross margins we're trying to go for, things like that. And then feasibility, quite often I'm heavily relying on technology, but not just technology leaders. I do try to pull in safety, compliance, regulatory people, sometimes legal, because, you know, just because you can build it doesn't mean you have the right to practice, or, you know, maybe there's a competing patent or something that's going to shut you down, or maybe there's regulatory stuff. So I really try to get technology leaders usually pioneer that conversation, but I do want other people that could represent feasibility. Maybe they're not part of the core team, but they can chime in on the risk there as well.
Mm-hmm. So if you are a product leader, for example, in an organization and you want to test a new idea in a completely new market, for example, or you want to explore a different avenue that hasn't been explored before, is it important that you get that, for example, product trio that, you know, product people talk about, you know, the product designer, the product manager, and for example, tech lead, which will, you know, who will take feasibility, desirability, viability, or do you recommend something else?
Well, I think ideas can come from anywhere inside a company. And so usually where I pick up is I'm not doing a lot of ideation with companies as much anymore. I can do that kind of work, but I'm really drawn to the testing part. And so usually they come in with some ideas. Now, those ideas might just have a single owner when I come in, right? Or they're just starting to form that team. And so what we try to do is keep it, whatever that combination is, we try to keep it really small at the beginning because we don't want to overinvest in it. So I've seen some of my companies in Silicon Valley, they'll throw, you know, 20 engineers at a really early stage idea. And what happens is they want to build, you know, that's what they do. They get paid to build. So, you know, what I try to say instead, let's keep the team small. Let's say maybe two or three people on that team, and then give ourselves permission to invest in that idea as we get more evidence that we're on the right track and it's worth investing in. So a proportional investment in it. So I've seen different flavors, but usually regardless of who's in that room, we try to keep it small at the beginning. And then we try to keep our experiments, you know, relatively light as far as evidence and go fast and cheap as much as we can early on, because I think people get really excited about the idea and they just want to throw a bunch of people at it right away and they want to scale it right away. And usually that's what kills an idea, is we scale it too quickly.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So I get the small part. What I see in some Scandinavian-based companies, for example, is that people want to do the 50-50 game. So for example, we have a product team working on an existing product, and then, okay, well, let's just test some idea. And they sort of say, okay, you're going to work 20% on exploring this idea and testing this idea, you're going to work 50%. What do you think about those context switchings? Do you usually advise companies to go, say, okay, we're going to go all in with a small 1-2 people, as you mentioned, or are you generally okay with people switching contexts?
I'm not generally okay with it, but it is the norm right now because most companies, they have a hard time reallocating people to a way where they say, look, we're just going to focus 100% on finding new opportunities. I wish more companies would do that, because quite often those small teams dedicated 100% can outperform, you know, 50, 100 people that are only dedicating 5, 10, 20% of their time. So mm-hmm. I like this idea of having small cross-functional teams that are 100% dedicated. I find that you can learn so much in 6 to 12 weeks compared to bigger, slower moving things where people are constant context switching. I also think with experimentation, you have to be careful, because that evidence you generate has an expiration date. It's not necessarily, you know, something you can revisit 6 months later and have it still be relevant sometimes, because the market moves so fast and things change. So I prefer having a small dedicated team, and some of my companies do that, but I say a majority of them are still trying to split percentages, and it slows everything down. And I think this is hard enough to do when you have a dedicated team. I think when you try to have people context switching and everything else, it makes it almost impossible, because it's so hard to succeed as it is. It's almost as if you're tying one hand behind their back and saying, now, okay, now create another $100 million business. I really wish the time allocation would be prioritized a bit differently.
Yeah. Something I see as well is that, you know, discovery and testing ideas is so fun that when you have these situations where you kind of, okay, you're going to do 50-50, it's never going to be 50-50, because if those people are really excited about experimenting and trying new things and really discovering this new opportunity, whether, you know, kind of gathering evidence to prove that this is a great idea or not, you know, it becomes just so fun that it's just very difficult for them as well. But going back to the different risks, so viability, feasibility, desirability, what do you think are the what do you think is the most difficult one for companies in general? What do people struggle the most with?
It's a mix-up between desirability and viability. They might be tied in a way.
Okay.
Most of the companies I go into are amazing at feasibility, you know. And I don't work just in software. I work in hardware. I work in services. I work in all these different kinds of companies. And the one thing I've seen across all of them has been their ability to execute, their ability to create new things. That's not the issue. The issue is they kind of skip the desirability, viability steps, and then they try to go big and they try to just push stuff to the market and have it and just sell it, you know? And so where I'm seeing that shift a little bit, at least in my clients anyway, are, hey, let's check for desirability before we go too far on feasibility. Let's check with desirability and viability. So I see my coaching anyway evolving over time, where I'm doing much less feasibility coaching anymore. I would say over the last 2 to 3 years, most of my coaching has been strictly on desirability and viability, because that's where the teams need help. They need to know, beyond interviews and surveys, what can we do to test demand to close that say-do gap? We need to know, how do we test pricing? You know, what is the most they would pay versus asking them what they would pay, you know, things like that. I find a lot of my coaching anyway, maybe I'm biased just because of what I'm doing, I find it's mostly drawn to desirability and viability. And then I look at how my book's being interpreted, you know, the book I wrote with Alex Osterwalder, I find it's being pulled into market research and product market research. I find it's being pulled into those categories more and more, that it's being used that way. I don't think people are flipping through the book and using a bunch of the feasibility experiments anymore. I think they're mostly focused on desirability and viability.
Right. Yeah, you touched on willingness to pay, for example, part of viability. I think that that is one area people struggle a lot with. I also think when it comes to viability, most PMs, if that is kind of the role who's mostly responsible for de-risking that, also struggle with navigating the organization to test different assumptions. So, for example, legal or involving sales or and so on. Do you have any specific tips or advice for how they can de-risk viability more effectively?
Yeah, I mean, as product, your success is tied to the business model. And I remember giving a talk at Mind the Product a while back in San Francisco, where I tried to really nail that message for the product people in the room, which was, in isolation, you're not going to succeed as a product manager or product person if you have a flawed business model. And so being able to facilitate that conversation is part of your skill set, or it needs to be. You're going to need to be able to pull in people that you start to understand how this fits into the rest of the org. And I've seen some interesting debates online about, you know, product people shouldn't be in charge of viability. And I think that's a very dangerous precedent to have, because, you know, as a product person, if you're inherently tied to the success of, does this generate revenue, or does this move the needle in some way in the company, even if it's a free product? Does it lead to generating revenue in some way eventually? If you're disconnected from that, I just feel as if you could have a really amazing, beautiful product and still fail because it has the wrong business model, or a business model that just doesn't make sense for the company.
I totally agree. Amen. So back to willingness to pay specifically then, because what I think most people talk about when you get into willingness to pay discussions is interviews and surveys using techniques like Van Westendorp, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, technique. Do you usually use those things, those techniques, survey techniques, or what's your kind of preferred ways to test willingness to pay, generically speaking?
Well, it's sort of going from that flow of light evidence to stronger evidence. You think of currency in a way, you know, what kind of currency are the customers using? In the beginning, they're usually using what they say. They're usually, they might move some stickies around and tell you a certain thing or rank things a certain way. They might give up their email to say they would pay, right? And then eventually you get to a point where you start collecting, you know, payment information and actually, you know, charging for the thing. And I think sometimes that's overlooked. We look at, well, something they said in the interview, they're just going to pay that amount now. And so much can happen in between you know, just what they say and then collecting payment information. And so what I try to suggest is, can we kind of increase the strength of evidence or in strength of currency through the process? As we learn more, ask more from the customers. It's time, it's giving up something, right? And I do a lot of B2B coaching. So quite often we might do something like a letter of intent where they're putting it in writing that they're willing to order so many units or sign a contract or something like that. But it's not the whole contract process. It's just, can we move it from what they say they're doing in an interview to, will they even put that in writing? And quite often they won't, you know? And then the team's always shocked by that of, wow, why didn't they put it in writing? They just said that. And it's because people, I don't want to say, you know, they're not completely honest with you, but sometimes there's some cognitive thing that happens when I put that in writing. Even if it's cancelable, it's not legally binding, you start to realize the currency of them putting in writing is a bit stronger, and what you thought was amazing pipeline of business is not real. And so there's a bunch of little techniques we can use along the way. I would say some of the ones in the book that I don't see people use anymore, things like the mock sales, it's a lot of work for potentially not great results. So for example, if you're going through this elaborate process to sell and then at the end you say, okay, this isn't an actual product we have ready yet, you can burn bridges that way, you can burn customers that way. So I would see some of the experiments in the book shifting more towards a test with instead of test on. So like testing with your customers. Mm-hmm. And so if you are kind of over time going from what they said to get it in writing, to then eventually doing some kind of pilot with them or an MVP where they're paying for it and you have some value exchange, like you're kind of testing with along the journey versus, you know, charging right away and then not having something you can deliver on or things like that. I see a more of a shift to testing with people over time.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. So is it dangerous for people to test both desirability and viability at the same time? So for example, if I'm trying to test willingness to pay for a value prop, and if the, you know, if I learn that the customer doesn't sign the letter of intent, for example, then I need to know whether that is because the price is too high or whether the value prop is indeed desirable. So do you usually have a sort of a standard recommendation of how teams can avoid getting into that trap?
Yeah, I tend to, well, it's one, it's really hard to test them in complete isolation because the desire, the job to be done, the pain or gain that the customers have is inherently tied to how much they're willing to solve for that or create that gain. And so it's really hard to tease them apart entirely. But I often say, let's just start with desirability testing and try to find, is there anything there before we get into the point of asking for some kind of currency with willingness to pay. And so it's hard for, I think it's more of just a mental thing where in my perfect world, in my coaching, right, you'd have assumptions map and you'd have a hypothesis where you've refined it to be testable, precise, and discrete. And then you might have many experiments to ultimately prove out or disprove that hypothesis. In practice, when I'm coaching, what I see teams want to do is they want to take a bunch of different experiments or maybe just like one big experiment and use it to test like 15 different hypotheses all at once, you know? And so they're like, for this one giant test, we can prove out an entire business. It's like, no, we have to unpack it, you know, and everything. And so they're just trying to be really efficient, right? They're like, yes. And so I see it's just mentally hard for teams to unpack the two because they want to compound. They want to take everything and into one big experiment and then say, yes, let's go build now after that. But when it comes to these early stage ideas, if you get desirability wrong, it's really, really hard to test viability. So I almost always recommend starting with desirability testing, seeing jobs, pains, and gains, value prop. Then you can back your way into what people have paid for that in the past or what they're willing to pay and all that. But without that desirability testing, I find it very hard to test viability. It's almost impossible, I think, to test in isolation.
Right. So no, I love that. And you mentioned, you know, dissecting assumptions into well-crafted hypotheses that are discrete, testable. Can you remind me what the three things are?
Yeah, precise, testable, and discrete. So precise being really clearly worded. Testable is like it can be shown true or false, or at least you have directional evidence proving or disproving. Discrete's more of like just don't have a bunch of and statements in there, you know, this and this and this and this, because that just makes it really hard when you run experiments to see what influenced what. So I tend to break those out into separate.
Okay, so like, we believe X customer segment is willing to pay $20 per month for our product. Is that a good assumption?
As long as the segment is clear, I think sometimes what I'm seeing is people put customers or something really general, and then ultimately we come down to the test and we say, well, okay, who are we testing with? There's so many different segments we have. You know, can we just pick one that, you know, has the problem, they're aware of the problem, they're actively seeking a solution to the problem? Can we test that segment first? So as long as the segment's clearly defined, and then I like putting a number in there, because at least that gives them something to respond to. It doesn't have to be the right number. It's your best guess versus just completely open-ended. You know, they'll pay enough, or we'll make enough profit, or it'll be good enough. And I look for the words that are kind of vague, and I try to get the teams to say, let's draw a line in the sand. Let's put some kind of threshold in there so that, you know, when we test, it's clear whether something is supporting that or not. Versus when it's really vague, then you come back with your evidence and it's, you know, people can interpret it 50 different ways, and then people get frustrated, and then ultimately the conversation comes back to, why are we experimenting at all? Because we could just be building.
Yeah. So in an ideal world, you do have a very, you know, beautiful assumption mapping with all the assumptions prioritized collaboratively. We take those assumptions, the risk assumptions, we dissect them into great hypotheses. We take those hypotheses, we design an experiment to test them. And then the question I have for you is, it's very important to sequence the experiments. And this is something that you describe beautifully in your book, and probably one of the most important contributions for product that I've seen, is this concept of sequencing experiments. But do you then, so you do all of this stuff, you get the hypothesis, and do you test with one experiment, or do you plan in advance for following, so for kind of next experiments? How do you do this? Like, do you focus on one experiment, or do you plan a bit ahead?
We plan a bit ahead, but there's a balance there. You don't want to necessarily create 20 experiment sequence, you know, that goes off and it looks like a giant waterfall chart. I think what'll happen in reality is you're going to run one or two experiments, and it's going to change things. Ideally, you're coming back to your assumptions map and you're saying, okay, we learned about this one. Actually, there's some other thing that came up we're going to put there. This one moved over, you know. And then maybe even come back to your business model canvas or whatever you're using as an input into this exercise and say, you know what, I think this value prop isn't a good value prop, and based on what we're hearing, and maybe we need to use a different value prop. So ideally, you're coming back and revisiting things, and then that's influencing your test plan. I think in reality, what teams are drawn to, kind of like the big experiment that I'm often pulled into, is they often view something like a canvas as a one-time thing. Like, I just created that at the beginning of this idea. I'm never going to look at that again. Or even the assumptions map, I just created that once. That's our map, and we're not going to revisit it. So I think there's some element of cultural change and mindset shift change that I'm still trying to foster in all my clients, where these are living documents. And so you're coming back and you're updating your map, you're updating your canvases, you're also updating your plan, you know, your experiment plan, your test plan, whatever you want to call that within your company. But it's not necessarily this mentality of, we're just going to execute over a course of time, and we're just going to do all, like, run all these experiments and everything's going to be fine. Quite often you learn new things. You learn the things that you thought were true aren't true. there are all these things that happen when you keep that mindset, that open kind of growth mindset. And so it's a lot of iterative process. And so I think I'm always nervous when people are wanting to take it and say, well, here's a linear process. I create my canvas, I extract, I map, I refine, and I create this giant plan, and I just execute on it. In a way, you're not necessarily paying down your risk that way, because there's an iterative nature to this, coming back and updating your artifacts and then learning from what you've tested and using that to change your plan. So,
great. So from the teams, some of the best teams you've coached, and or, you know, some of the best companies you've worked with, what are some of the habits that they have that other, you know, just good teams don't have? When it comes to this iteration mindset, iterative mindset.
Yeah, I mean, they're curious. They're very curious teams, and they're open-minded. And so they're constantly going, well, how will we go test that? Or what's the assumption we're making in this? And not to the point where it paralyzes them, but to the point where they can go off and it shapes their strategy based on what they've learned. So I'm always looking for that loop, right? I'm looking for people mm-hmm. that have tried something, it didn't quite pan out the way they thought. And then how they respond to that is everything. And so they come back and they reevaluate things and they come up with new hypotheses, new tests, and they run through it until they get something that works or doesn't. And so I'm really looking for that loop in teams. I'm looking for teams that aren't taking necessarily a check the box mentality of, yep, mm-hmm. create an experiment, now give me all the money I need to build the thing, right? I don't want them treating it just as simply a box they need to check to get to where they want to build, because quite frankly, a lot of my clients right now are just have a running tab of all the projects we've killed. And they're saying, here's how much money we've saved because we didn't go forward with these. So I think there's a flip side to this where you can actually save the company money by not investing in things that don't work. And if you think about all the projects you've been on in the past, I imagine there have been some where you're just like, why did I spend N number of months on this thing when if we just killed it earlier, I would have been freed up to do other things. And so I'm really trying to foster that mentality, like help create that culture of experimentation in companies. And I'm having a lot of fun doing it. There are companies where they're getting it. And then the problem moves around. Like now it's, oh, we have to work on the funding, and now we have to work on leadership, and we have to work on the quality of ideas coming through. You know, it always kind of moves around. But the good teams are always curious, open-minded, willing to go try, willing to be wrong, you know, or just being wrong isn't a paralyzing thing or penalized for them.
Great. So do they time box these things? Like do you feel that these teams, even though they have the mindset and clearly the support from leadership to pursue these opportunities and tests, do you see that most of them have a time box, and then in the end of, for example, let's say a sprint of 12 weeks, they are forced to take a decision? Or how do you see that these best teams perform in which context?
Yeah, ideally it's tied, all this is tied to some kind of funding decision, because otherwise it can feel a little bit like theater where, I'm running experiments and everything, but if ultimately that doesn't influence your funding, then that's how they view it as a check the box exercise. It's more like, yep, check the box, whatever, I'm gonna get my money. So usually I'm trying to help companies integrate this into their decision-making and their funding. And now every company is different. And some of my larger companies, even every division is different. It's not like there's a standard funding mechanism across the company. And I'm learning that as I go into more and more companies, and I work in, you know, really big ones and also like mid-size. So what I'm trying to do is understand their funding and how they make decisions. And then how does this feed into that? And can we, you know, score teams or look at where they're at and say, this is the evidence you've generated. Do we pivot, persevere, or kill this based on the evidence? And what I love to see is I want to see the team and their recommendation 9 times out of 10 be aligned to that sponsor or whoever's making that ultimate decision on whether or not it gets funding. I don't want to see a lot of misalignment there. So during the process, we're having check-ins, we're keeping people in the loop, because the team could really get demoralized if they come in and they make a really strong recommendation and it's completely different from the mindset and the perspective of their sponsors. And so I'm trying to foster that communication earlier so that, you know, they're seeing, oh, here's your assumptions map, but our sponsor's saying, oh, wait, there's this other really risky assumption we're not thinking about. Let's see if we can test that too. Versus they get to the end, there's a funding decision, and the sponsor's going, oh, but you forgot this. And, you know, and so I'm really trying to help people talk to each other along the way so that doesn't happen.
No. So, okay, so metered funding is important, and usually, you know, it requires leadership buy-in. They have to structure the whole way they fund development and exploration of new opportunities. So I'm thinking, you know, it requires finance to be involved and so on and so forth. So that can be sort of done by leadership primarily to avoid this analysis paralysis and to have a more sort of structured approach to innovation. But on the team side, what have you learn that helps them with analysis paralysis the most, apart from time boxing their experiments, for example?
Yeah, time boxing definitely helps. You know, being a small team helps as well, you know, because you just have, you know, 2 to 3 people in the team, and there's you can get some inertia and momentum with the team. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, also if they're going up until, if they know, oh, we have this amount of runway until we have to make a decision on that idea, whether we keep going with it or we pivot it or we kill it, that also you can kind of work back from that and say, well, what can we test up until then? Mm-hmm. I would say also focusing on desirability helps, you know, because I think that is an angle where if they're just feasibility focused and they're focusing in a customer free zone, you know, they can just do analysis all day, right? But when we're forcing them to get out and talk to customers, that kind of influences their direction. So yeah, I would just say keeping teams small, time boxing for sure, and also, you know, going after desirability, viability. You have to test with customers in that aspect. So it's not necessarily a zone where you get to play in just cool tech all day and just just keep analyzing things. You have to you know, take it and make a decision.
Right. Okay, so when it comes to time boxing, I have seen, and I've done it myself, using OKRs, which should be outcome-driven, the key results. And so by using confidence as the outcome, then you start kind of getting that time boxing in a certain way that the teams are already used to. But I've heard mixed opinions about this. I want to hear your take on it. So basically using OKRs for learning and kind of time boxing.
I've seen it be okay. It's not something, I'm not an expert in OKRs. I think I've worked with some people that are, and we've tried to do some fun things like take assumptions mapping and apply it to OKRs and things like that. But I think when it comes down to time boxing, you know, if it depends on the industry I'm working in. So for example, if I'm working with a really fast B2C company that is software focused, we might run an experiment every couple of days, or at least an experiment a week, and we just say that's our cadence, right? We have to run at least an experiment a week. And then you fast forward 12 weeks, you could say, well, we have at least 12 experiments worth of evidence to help directionally point us in a direction, like where we're going to pivot this or persevere this or kill this. Where it's more challenging is some of my B2B customers might be hardware, they might be something that's, it takes them a month to do something because of the physics involved and everything, right? So their experiments cadence might be slower, but at the same time, when you relate that to how they're typically working when I come in, it's exponentially faster than how they've worked before, right? So something that might take 3 years to do, we're doing it in a few months. So it really challenges me when I bounce between industry to industry to say, okay, how fast can you go responsibly, you know, and can we time box this work so that we don't need 100% certainty to make a decision? And I think that's where people get tripped up in the time boxing is, well, I need to be completely certain, or I need to get this right. And I think that comes from a culture of you're rewarded when you're right. And that starts off in schooling and goes off through your career. You know, I was rewarded and promoted because I was right and all that.
Yeah.
So I think this idea of you don't have to be 100% right to make a decision is a cultural thing I'm still working with. And I work with a bunch of companies outside the US where I have the idea of failure is just perceived differently, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the time boxing, I just try to keep them going and get momentum. And then depending on the industry, it's, you know, software can be really fast, but hardware B2B might be really slow. But in relation to it, I want them to go faster than they have been progressing.
Yeah, no, that's such a great point, especially the failure comment you had. I also think storytelling is so important on that. So, for example, teams that have saved companies a lot of money through running the experiments, it's not that, you know, a lot of executives, they expect a product out of those experiments. They don't expect an idea to be killed and then, okay, we're on to the new one. And so great storytelling is very important to get that right. And you also mentioned that one of the challenges, especially in B2B, is that some of these experiments take time, especially with hardware or, you know, highly regulated industries. What else have you found to be kind of big challenges in the B2B space, apart from this? Anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, I've been working a lot in sustainability efforts over the last couple of years.
Okay.
And I think that's one of the challenges right now. It's mostly B2B, but it's not necessarily unique to B2B, which is people prioritizing sustainability over viability or vice versa. And so I've been helping teams run a lot of preference and prioritization experiments where they're trying to understand, okay, yes, you say you want to be more sustainable, but what does that mean? Even if what the sustainable solution costs more, you know, or how do we offset that cost? And so I've been focused a lot in preference and prioritization and testing different business models. I think it's always a challenge with B2B because you probably have a smaller customer base, you know, as far as companies, right, versus just mass market consumer. And there's that pressure, that added tension of, oh wow, if we lose that customer, that might have ripple effects, or if we have a bad test, or if we get it wrong. And so I've been trying to change this culture of, we only talk to our customers when we have something to pitch them, that's a solution to sell them, to can we get further upstream and have them talk about their problems and the tangential stuff going on around our solutions with them. And it's been a kind of a multi-year effort of mine with some of my clients where we're just trying to change that culture. Because I think in B2B, it's like, you're talking to me, I expect you to be selling me and pitching me. And that's been the way for a long time. And so now we're trying to unwind that and say, no, I'm not trying to pitch you yet anyway. I'm trying to understand your pains. And so that can be a bit awkward in B2B. So it's a lot of discovery experiments I'm finding in B2B. The validation stuff later down the road, that feels more comfortable to them. But the idea that we're open-ended exploring things with customers is it feels very awkward and uncomfortable for some of the teams.
Yeah, that's definitely something I've seen too. The struggle to, well, first of all, the struggle to find customers in B2B for some companies or some teams. I actually posted a survey on LinkedIn asking what's your biggest challenge testing ideas, or I think it was testing willingness to pay, I think it was. And to my surprise, number one, probably for mostly B2B folks, was finding customers to talk to. And I know you cover quite a bit of that in the book. Do you have any sort of practical advice? If I'm working B2B and I'm struggling a lot to find customers, what do I do? Where do I go?
Yeah, I find that pretty challenging in B2B compared to B2C. And usually the advice, although it's kind of similar advice, I say, okay, for your value prop or your solution, potential solution you have, like this idea of, do they have the problem? Are they aware and actively seeking a solution? And so I still use that framework a lot with teams. And then it's more of, okay, so do you have any observable evidence of people actively seeking a solution to what you have? And then where are they seeking that? And so I find that's a lot of trial and error, but it could be LinkedIn. Because LinkedIn's a great example, especially now. LinkedIn is an amazing platform. I find it hard me saying that. LinkedIn is an amazing platform. It is, though. For especially B2B sales, it's amazing. And so there are plenty of groups. You can segment. You can find those kinds of companies. Are they actively talking about what they're trying to solve, you know, publicly? Trade shows are a good one. It may sound kind of old school, but even webinars where you are talking about the problem, right? Not just pitching your solution, but talking about the problem and how it exists and what you're observing in the market. People love that stuff if they're, you know, trying to find more people that could potentially solve it. So I always keep coming back to that, you know, is it no matter what your sector is and what your business, you have people that they have the problem. There's observable evidence they have it. Are they even aware that they have it? Because if they're not, then you have to do more awareness building, right? And then are they actively seeking, which is ideally the best? Are they actively seeking and are there places they would go seek, and can we get in front of them while they're seeking? And B2B, I know it might sound hard, but quite often people are using, you know, publicly available places to look for solutions in B2B. It's becoming more common. So I would ask my teams those kinds of questions and then come up with a list and then start testing those locations online, offline, because sometimes it's offline as well. and get your value prop in mm-hmm. front of them. So if it's offline, it's more old school, maybe like a brochure that you're handing them, right? Versus online, it's like digital version. But practicality wise, it's really just trying to find where are they actively seeking a solution and can I get in front of them? And that's going to take a bit of resilience to find what works there.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Super. So just shifting a little bit just to cover more like on a leadership level. So we talked about metered funding. We talked about getting a small team to work together, preferably 100% of the time to focus on one certain opportunity. We talked about time boxing experiments, which should come naturally from the team. But of course, if you are a product leader, you can try to coach them in that direction as well. What else do you think I should do as a product leader to foster this culture of experimentation and continuous discovery in my company, if I'm a product leader listening to this?
Well, there's an element of repetition to this. So buckle up, it's going to take a while, because as soon as you stop talking about it, people will stop doing it or stop thinking about it, I've noticed. And this, some of the most high-profile companies I've worked with over the years have got this great momentum, and then the leaders made this assumption that, okay, now people are just going to work this way without me talking about it, and I can move on to something else. And as soon as they did that, people reverted back to what they were doing before. So there's an element of behavior change here, and I know you might feel like, oh my gosh, they do not want to hear this from me again. Oh yes, they do, and they need to hear it from you again. So that's one thing when I talk to product leaders and my clients, is that keep talking about experimentation, keep talking about asking what the riskiest assumption is, what evidence do you have of this? Like keep asking those questions, because once you stop asking them, they'll just slip back into build and they will come mode. Mm-hmm. Other tangible things I would say that would just require practice over time. Things like the words you use are really important. So try to make it more about creating an environment where the teams can bring you information and you make a decision together, versus just telling the teams what experiments to run, right? To make it so that they can come with you and give an account of how they're making progress. Try to not speak in first person all the time. That's another one. You know, as product leaders, you're probably promoted because you were really good at something, and that's where you are today. It can easily start to become you're just giving teams the benefit of your opinion, but they'll take it as orders and they'll run with it, and then you'll be surprised that, oh wait, I didn't mean you to go do that. And they'll say, but you mentioned it, right? And so be careful of the words you use and talking in first person. So try to talk in third person, like we, us, our. Try to ask questions. What's your riskiest assumption? Oh, have you thought about how to test that? What do you think as far as should we keep going with this or pivot it or kill it? Try to give it a point where, yes, there's a goal and you're still maybe defining that goal, but the teams are giving you an account of how they're making progress. And it's a lot of, I don't like using the phrase like soft skills a lot, but it's a lot of like, how do you mentor? How do you coach? How do you still lead? And I think it's really easy to fall back to, I know best. I've seen this story play out before, and I'm just going to tell the team what to do, right? It's mostly about getting them to have an environment that's safe enough where they can talk about how they're surfacing these risky assumptions and how they're testing them. And that's really important as a product leader, to foster that as much as possible and create more leaders around you if you have that kind of opportunity.
That's fantastic. Great. David, so to basically close this fantastic conversation, do you have any specific examples of specific companies that are really good at this stuff that people should kind of look into?
Really good companies. I'm trying to think. People that are amazing at this usually don't need my help. You look at like the Netflixes of the world, right? And one of the things I was always recommending to people is if you want to know if companies are good at this, go check out their job postings. Go check out who they're hiring for. And if you see a lot of things about qualitative and quantitative research, and you see things about experimentation. And I've seen job postings with assumptions mapping in them now, which is a bit surreal to me, and testing business ideas, lean startup, design thinking. just go check out their job postings, and you'll get a feel for whether or not they value this kind of work and they're doing it well. As far as my personal, I mean, I've worked with a bunch of companies over the years. I always point to like companies like Adobe. I really love how they test their way through things. And I think they're even doing amazing stuff with this, you know, all this wave of AI and how they're methodically testing their way through AI. I think it's amazing. Yeah, I think, I mean, it's really hard for me to just point to one company doing it well. I would just say it's starting to become a little more mainstream as far as the language is making it into product management in general. It's kind of permeating it.
Yeah.
And I see still just a really strong need for fundamentals, though. You know, I wish we were a little more advanced at this stage, but I'm seeing you can't skip steps. So there's a lot of just... Yeah. Repeating fundamentals, making sure people understand this, it's very much needed.
I totally agree. And I think lack of great product leadership is one of the reasons why we are making baby steps, but we could have perhaps making bigger leaps. But from what I see, you know, product leadership is such an important role because, as you mentioned, you're going to lead with strategic context, the teams. You're going to ensure that those teams have the right talent to discover certain problems or opportunities. You're going to coach these people on how to work together to test those ideas using tools like the ones you advocate for and the ones you, you've designed, and, you know, getting their book in their, on their desks, and very, very small things like this can actually change a whole organization. So besides from your great book, Testing Business Ideas, David, what other resources do you recommend folks to read?
Yeah, I mean, there was such a huge void in the market, which is why I think the book, one of the reasons the book is doing so well. I've seen some other books pop up around it. I think there's still plenty of space in the market for more knowledge around this. I would say, you know, anything out of the Strategizer Toolkit is going to be good for anybody. I think even going back to some of the previous books and maybe reading them again, you know, if you go back to Lean Startup, the first time you read it maybe 10 years ago or so, it has a different meaning to it now when you go back through and you see, oh, this is what we meant by, you know, growth versus value and all. So I think, you know, there's not like a specific list of books I'd recommend. Online, the great thing is there's more and more stuff every day. You know, I personally have been working on some community stuff. I like doing more cohort-based training where you take people over a series of weeks and not just simply a workshop. So that's been my focus, is more of a program or a cohort-based kind of experience where people can take this stuff and try it and then learn and then get some help over time. Because I think workshops are great. I'm amazing at facilitating them, but they're kind of this isolated time box. And, you know, putting it into practice afterwards, the longer you wait to put it into practice after that, the less you retain and the less chance you're going to apply it. So I'm really digging the whole cohort training, longer program stuff. I find it's makes it stick a bit better.
Cool. Noted. And finally, David, where can people find you? You mentioned LinkedIn, but is that the main platform you're using these days to post knowledge and memes?
Yes, LinkedIn has been my main platform. I have to say, you know, Twitter was it for a while, and now it's LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram, although I'm not that active there. YouTube channel's growing. I keep putting little snippets there. You can find me there, cool, too. And then davidjbland.com is my personal site, and precoil.com is my business. So there's a good chance you're going to find links to all the different stuff from those two as well.
Awesome. Great conversation, David. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, that was it for today. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Make sure you subscribe to my newsletter so you don't miss out, and see you next time.